Welcome. Those of you who are joining us in the middle, you should have two outlines. Did they get two outlines, Jill? The one from last week?
Oh, I didn't get out there.
Okay, can you do that? Okay. There's an outline from the past 2 weeks for those of you. I'm going to be referencing it, so you want to make sure you have it. This is the penultimate conclusion to the series. I had done something on Song of Solomon, and people wanted something on Little Foxes in relationship, so I'll be doing that next week. But this is the overview of the process of Wink to Wedding. The way I got in doing this is a number of years ago, we were involved in serving a church down in Chinatown, and there were a number of guys there who were absolutely clueless about what you had to do to develop a relationship, particularly with someone of the opposite sex. They weren't even too good on the guy relationships. So I said, look, it's pretty simple. It starts with a wink and it ends with a wedding. So what about all that stuff in between? So most relationships start out with people meeting each other, and like marriage relationships. And one of the things I've made in past comments that it's not necessarily God's will for people to be married, but it is God's will for people to develop Christ-like character. And Christ-like character makes for a really good relationship. So we'll take a look at the whole thing, and I was going to do this at the beginning, and I thought I'd create discontent. People would just want to jump to the steps. So what I did is I covered some of the contentment and the stuff that's really important first, like, you know, Lord of the Ringless, have one desire to rule them all, which is this desire to please God. And thank you for the she we keep. all right. Then there's, waiting for God to have him meet your needs. And then eventually you have Prince Charming, Sleeping Beauty, the two previous sermons in this outline. And then finally this is, there was something in there about not waking love until it pleases. And I'll review these again in two minutes. But then there's this overall arching timeline. And so I'm doing it at the end because hopefully I just avoided discontent in the beginning. So the basic timeline comes out of Genesis, and Jesus quoted it in the Gospels. It's pretty simple. It's leave, it's cleave, and then there's one flesh relationship. By the way, it goes this way, not the other way. And our culture, it kind of goes the other way. You meet someone, you get one night stand with them, and then, hey, they were pretty cool. So then you develop a relationship with them and then say, hey, it's been a couple of years. Why don't we get married? My parents are on my case for some kids, So the biblical thing is there was a social legal declaration that, hey, we're going to do this thing. Then there was the emotional bonding. It's like two pieces of paper being glued together such that if you tried to separate them, they'd rip each other apart. And then there's the physical intimacies of the one flesh relationship. And we'll talk about how even the brain chemistry behind that works, which the scriptures didn't explicitly mention, but it's inherent in this. So what you first need to do is figure out what are the functions that should be expressed at a particular point along this timeline, and then you figure out the form of expressing the function biblically. So great architecture, great relationships, form follows function. What's supposed to happen, then what form does it take? It's worth considering, what's the purpose of marriage? It's not necessarily kids, propagation of the species. No, you can do that apart from it, and not all people married have kids, so there's like other things. And to set this up, if you go into Truth Base, which is this little guy up here, you'll find something called Toil, Time of Your Life, which is that thing down here. And it is a time and life management seminar, and it has objectives for different areas of your life. This is the relationships objective part. So a bad objective, this is bad, don't do this, is to get your needs met through other people. When we're dealing with the subject of marriage, it's, get your needs met through your spouse and children. I want a trophy spouse and I want trophy kids so I can feel worthy and valuable. Or even in just a non-marriage relationship, I want my need for companionship or fun, I don't know if I put fun on here, met through another person. And that's really using the other person. And the better thing is to get those needs met by God, which is the gist of waiting for God and having a relationship where you seek his face. He communicates with you through his word. And then you're free to meet the needs of others. So the marriage relationship thing, this is right out of Toil. To profitably, I'll come back to what that means, reflect the unity, love, and wisdom of God. And then you got a little thing on what unity, love, and wisdom are. Your outline has this one. to profitably mirror, like mirror, mirror on the wall, it's a whole fairy tale series thing, reflect God's unity. That's like three in one. There's three distinct personalities, but they blend together for a certain objective. And that is also characterized by self-sacrificial, other-centered love for eternal objectives in all potential and actualized relationships. Potential and actualized. Oh, this is hurting my head. What does that mean? It's ones that have potential of turning into a lifetime commitment and ones that actually do. So you basically, in all that you do, whether you are a single, you're planning on being a monk for the rest of your life or whatever, you want to be reflecting God in your life. That's the purpose of him leaving us here on earth. So that's the general gist. It's not to make you happy. Trust me, marriage does not automatically make you happy. The people who have the, you know, just absolutely have the most horrible problems with hate are those who are married to someone that doesn't work out too well. So we'll look at that in 2 minutes a little bit more. So this starts with, this is an excerpt from the previous sermons, with a commitment to Christlikeness. And on the Prince Charming sermon and the Sleeping Beauty one, I said, any two people committed to being Christlike can have a great relationship. Is there the one? Is there my soulmate out there? Is there this one person that is going to be my all in all? Yes, he's called Jesus, all right? He is the one. He is your all in all, all right? There are, you know, lots of things. In fact, I'm going to show you an article that I violently disagree with some of it, but it has a number of good things in it to such extent that I'm actually going to show it to you. It's on your outline. It says, oh, don't give up all this thought of there being this one. But as I mentioned in the Song of Solomon and repeated in the Sleeping Beauty Prince Charming series, if the God who created us and wove us together has such order and purpose in his creation, then this relationship that has such a huge impact on your happiness and well-being and everything else probably has a counterpart that could design you. So the question that we should not be asking is that the one? Is this the one? Is that the one? The question we should be asking is, what's God's will? What does God want me to do? And then do it. So don't be looking for the one, but recognize that when Adam was asleep in the will of God, God brought his spouse to her, him. Psalm 84:10 is a verse that God's used in my life, and I've told you about this before, but if you have the perspective that one day with God is better than 1,000 elsewhere, then you're on the right track, then the reason that should be is because the Lord God is a sun and a shield. He gives grace and glory, and here's the key thing. No good thing will he withhold from them who walk uprightly. What do you have control over? Walking uprightly. You walk according to what God has revealed, and then anything that he withholds is not good. And then there's this whole thing about be holy in all you do, because that's his will for us. Holy means separate or distinct. Don't be like your culture. Your culture is not necessarily derived from the scriptures. In previous generations in our history, there are periods where the culture has been more biblical. Our culture, not so much. It's kind of departed. So some of the ways of implementing this is don't wake in love until the appropriate time. That is the major message from the book of the Song of Solomon, which is how to have a great relationship. And it's not just sexual, it's emotional. It is a phenomenal relationship. And in the book, he tells us how to do it. And three times in the book, this is refrain. I charge you. This is really the point of the book. Don't wake in love until the appropriate time. The question becomes, what's the appropriate time? How do you know? You know, well, this little cupid comes down, hits you with an arrow. And on the arrow is a little message that says, appropriate time, but, you know, all right, yeah. No, you know, you have to be seeking God's will for that. So being content, Lord of the Ringless, have the desire that you want to do God's will, and that desire will rule all your others. For those fans of Jane Austen, you might recognize a little parody on this, Purity and Spousability. Anybody say that? Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility. All right. I know it was a stretch. but the themes of that of Jane Austen are pretty decent, and you might want to refer to them, refresh your thinking about that, or get the spark notes. But that's where you get Waiting for God, Searching for Sleeping Beauty, and Waiting for Prince Charming. The big idea is you're asleep in the will of God, and God doing God's will, and God brings the person to you. Someone's going to say, if they're both asleep, how are they going to meet? Well, obviously they meet at a sleep clinic, and I'll talk about that in a discussion time. Those of you who can think on multiple tracks can be pondering, what does he mean by sleep clinic? All right, another thing in terms of the purity thing, don't train yourself to like something that's not good for you. All right. People tend to do that. So we find something we like, oh yeah, I want more and more of it. The scriptures are pretty clear. You should abstain from every form of evil. And in 1 Thessalonians 4, he actually talked about some things that are evil. So you can go back and look at that. Actually, we'll look at it. And 1 Peter 2, this is for your benefit. Abstain from fleshly lust, as you know, pilgrims are just passing through, which war against your soul. And we tend to think, oh, well, indulging my desires, it's good. That's why I got the desires. No, you got the desires so you can actually use them according to God's purposes. He has a plan for fulfilling them. If you waken them too soon, your soul is going to be at war with yourself. Okay, there's a lady that I enjoy. She's got some TED Talks. She is probably the most quoted authority on relationships, romantic and sexual. Helen Fisher. And she, her shtick is she does brain scans of people in various situations. So she can actually say, I want to get one of these machines. You know, is it a helmet? Is it one of those scanner things? Can I use my phone for that? That actually kind of measures what chemicals are going on in your brain and what they're doing based on various stimuli. And one time I was majoring in neurobiology, and we didn't have access to the machines back then, but that would have been a real cool thing. Her view, and I don't totally buy her view. Her view is that there are three systems that are at work in our brain that kind of develop relationships and attachment and all that other good stuff. And the thing from her perspective, and this is in a TED Talk called Why We Stray, is that these three systems can be focused on three different people at the same time. And it causes a whole bunch of chaos. You're basically, and from her view, she's an evolutionary anthropologist. So her data is good. Her conclusions are almost humorous. In order to find some basis for her, and this is not just a slight against her, it's like almost all the people in the field, they have to find some basis for their theories. So they say, in prehistoric times, how do we know that? What's prehistoric? Before history. What went on then? Fiction. All right, because I'm a Western Civ history guy, and I know we have records that go back to the beginning. There is no prehistory. You know, it's like you have to posit something that doesn't exist to back up a theory that is bogus. But anyway, this stuff is interesting. There's chemicals. Testosterone is the driver for erotic love, sexual love. Dopamine is the driver for romantic love. And oxytocin is the driver for attachment. And then there's another chemical that comes almost as a process, serotonin. These guys are old pathways that develop into serotonin, and that's the one for the philos, the stroge, the affection kind of love. So you actually can see her three systems matching some of what goes on in terms of love in scripture. The strongest thing for in her mind is the romantic love. She has this great quote, which I might as well get out of the way now so I can dump it, put new things in the processor. And it goes something like this. She says, people don't kill themselves when they get turned down for a one-night stand. But they do kill themselves when a romantic relationship breaks up. And her take is that romance and romantic love is far, far stronger than Eros. And can do far more damage to people if used incorrectly. Oxytocin, one of the products of love, is the thing that binds a couple together after the other brain chemicals start dissipating. So the testosterone, which is a driver for so much, is one of the things that is actually one of the weakest forms of brain system and should be kept in perspective. Our culture thinks otherwise, but that's their prerogative.
Question?
Yes.
Can you comment on C.S. Lewis's Four Loves? I was looking at some of them because they line up. You talked about the four ones, but do you think it's helpful, useful?
Oh yeah. Well, whenever you're doing Bible study and you see a word, you want to understand its context. So Lewis has in his book called The Four Loves, He's not a theologian, by the way. He's a good medieval writer. And I profited from some of the stuff he said and other stuff. I'd say, yeah, I might want to take a Schlusssicher with that. But there is, Eros is one of them. That's some of the love that is reflected in the Song of Solomon. But in the Greek translation of the Song of Solomon, agape is the kind of love that's in there. So when I did the Song of Solomon, when I actually, you can go back and take a look at that one, I referenced the different kinds of loves there. The agape love is the kind of love where it's a choice to do what is in another's best interest, even if you don't feel like it. You know, it's like to do what's in their best interest. Parents have this kind of love for their kid. When you have to discipline your kids, you don't feel like disciplining your kids. It's their best interest, and it's in obedience to God that you basically get them to behave like civilized human beings. There's the Philadelphia kind of love, which is a brotherly sister kind of love. This is not the, you know, kick and pull each other's hair out, and, you know, which some siblings are wont to do. But it's a family kind of love. And then there's a stroge love. I guess, you know, if they had, you know, animal pets back in the day, you know, that would probably be a function of that. But Paul actually uses a word for stroge. It's not, he puts a prefix in front of it in the New Testament. So you see all those things. They have different settings. We all experience them, all of them to some extent at some time. So breaking them apart, it's all going to be passage dependent. And then you have to look at the context to see how it fits. I spent some time in previous sermons dealing with don't defraud others, 1 Thess 4. And I just need to reference, if you reject this, you're really rejecting God. So you might want to give some thought to it. You know, it's like, does God know what he's doing, or do you know better? They had a brotherly love. This is a warning against the erotic love up top. Don't defraud others and abstain from immorality, fornication. To defraud is to take someone from another by defraud or deception. This happens a lot in clubs. And deception is deliberately practiced in order to secure an unfair or unlawful gain. And you're depriving someone, either person or even yourself or even someone in the future, of something that is illegitimate for you to have at that moment. So I talked about that under the previous sermons, and I've got to cover more stuff, so I don't want to take questions on that now. 1 Corinthians 7:1, similar thing. Bad relationships, objective, get your needs met through another person. Better one is to first be a friend of God, then you get your needs met, and then you're free without any strings attached to serve and love the other, and that's the kind of relationships you want to strive for. Okay, so once you're committed to that stuff, you're now ready to go out your front door. You need to have that commitment down, that relationship with God down, and then this other stuff will work very well. It's kind of like you get a manual for a computer of some sort. I still haven't looked at the manual for this thing, and that's why I still can't figure out how to use Windows 8. But I'm hoping my kids will just fill me in. But if I just start going in there and, you know, gunking around and, you know, pushing things here and there without understanding having the prerequisites down, like plug in the machine, I'm going to say, this thing doesn't work. So you got to kind of get the first pieces of a relationship with God to work, and then the things follow. So two verses from the Apostle Paul that I think are worth keeping in the forefront of your thinking is in chapter 9. He says, I've become all things to all men that I might all means save some. His interaction with other people was other-centered. He wanted to benefit them. He wanted to help them. He wasn't using them. And when you are, quote, on the prowl, this should still be, some of you can sleepwalk, prowl, you know, sleep prowl. You want to be looking to help the other person. As we have opportunity, he said to the Galatians, let's do good to all, especially those who are the household of faith. But our posture going forward is not to commit random acts of kindness, but purposefully love people according to their need for their best interest, ultimately resulting in God's glory. Whew, it's a mouthful. There's stuff like that in Toil if you want to get the written version of it. So it starts with having that mindset and then being engaged and accessible. People who are self-conscious versus other-centered are not going to be even looking at other people. So it's hard to get that wink in. You know, it's like they're thinking about me, you know, and, you know, they aren't other-centered. If they are involved and engaged in doing God's will, they will be around people And that's how relationships develop, both gal pals and guy pals. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but a power, love, and a sound mind. The word worth looking up, it's a saved in mind. It's a mind, and if you look at the lexicons, that the passions are controlled. So even the passion of fear is something that needs to be controlled, and God gives us the power to do that. Okay, then it gets down to the nitty-gritty stuff. Initially, there's eye contact, followed by one of these things. Let's see if I can do it. I'll do it right here. One there, and one there. All right, the smile. They're showing their teeth. That doesn't mean they want to bite. No, it's a receptivity. It's showing, oh, you know, there's also they look and look away. I saw that with one of my kids, one of the guys, in a shopping cart when they were 2 years old, you know, flirting with these 50-year-old women in the grocery store, thinking, what's going on? How do you know how to do that? Must have been watching his mother. Okay. All right. So there's eye contact, there's smile, and then there's talk, right? You got to talk. And you keep the talk short. When I was looking up trying to find Helen Fisher's video, I came across something from, I don't even know if I got it. Is it Woosk? Is that the one with the follow your heart or whatever? And it said, you know, basically keep it short. The woman is more, I shouldn't be telling this, should I? Yeah, I will. Impressed with, like, your words only account for 9% of what she perceives. Isn't that amazing? You think of all the times guys work out, what do I say? You know, how much does a polar bear weigh? I don't know. Enough to break the ice. Hi, my name is Bill. Yeah, no, it's like, that's not the way to do it, all right? But you could use it if you're desperate. Gals, if you ever hear that, he's desperate, run. All right. So in the conversation, your tendency is one to impress. And, you know, that's self-centered. Be other-centered. Find out about the person. Find out. You want to understand them. What are their needs? What are their vision? What are their values? Looking for some other-centered commonality that you're interested in same things. This is probably not the thing to start right off the bat, but that's what you're looking for, you're listening for, you know, become observant. I talked last week about people who go hunting are really pretty good at this. They know how to stalk their prey. you observe before you go in to say, is the polar bear between their cubs or not? You know, it's like, so you want to be there. Okay, then what happens is you've gotten some feedback. There's been some interaction. You've gotten some feedback. And there's an evaluation that goes on and a filtering that goes on, which gives you that feedback. And it's either rejection or reciprocation. Normally the reciprocation is when the head goes like this, up and down, as opposed to this, side to side. Yeah, that's like, yeah. There's other fish in the pond. This one is, they're nodding. Oh, that's and the relationship can continue. The question that you should be asking along this line early on is, in what ways are they insane? Now, I do a lot of biblical research, but I also am a student of the social sciences. I sift through the research that people have come up with in other realms. So I want to finish the screen, and I'm going to talk about why you should be asking what way they're insane. But there's some reciprocation. There's some indication that they want the relationship to continue. And it's not necessarily a marriage relationship. It's just as two people interact with each other. There's a commonality. Friendships are about having things in common. Go see some of the toil stuff. Eventually, if you're lucky, there is repeated interaction because there's encouragement. There's relating. And then a relationship develops in which there is self-disclosure. It's really the way relationships always work. And this can take place in 2 minutes. Or it can take place over repeated interactions. It's a relatively small. There's contact. It's in a group setting. And that's how the relationship first develops. Let's see if I can do this without ruining everything. Yes! Okay. This is something called Philosopher's Mail. It's an article which is pretty decent. It's either written by a group of people or a schizophrenic because there are multiple perspectives in the article. If you grade enough papers, you kind of can, or read enough textbooks, you can figure out, oh, yeah, this is conglomerated, this is put together here, this is saying something different. And I haven't heard some of this stuff in this article since the hippie days, All right, so you got some people who are totally rebelling against the establishment. I went through and looked at their, quote, faculty. Very educated people, very anti-God. They're open to everything except dogma. They're very dogmatic about that. They don't want to bring anything about God into the picture. But they had some really good perceptions, and they got some great graphics. The couple that you see here, how we end up marrying the wrong people. So it's inevitable there are going to be difficulties, but sometimes, this was well written, there are couples with such primal grinding mismatch, such deep-seated incompatibility that one has to conclude that something has gone very, very wrong. These people shouldn't be together. So we have our two celebrities from across the sea. Reasons for this, real quick, and I sent out this in the email link to people, and I have to warn you, it's R-rated. It's, you know, and lot to dislike, but also some insights. We don't understand ourselves, and that's because our friends basically are just using us for a good time. They're not going to bring up stuff that makes us socially awkward unless they really love us. There's my hero, Woody Allen. primary example of that. Then we don't understand other people, so that's another good one. Then this is an interesting picture. You look at this and you say, oh, that's a person. But then they point out she's got no nostrils. She only has 8 strands of hair. We kind of fill in the details, and we kind of think because we have a few little pieces, we know the whole thing. And they go into saying, oh, yeah, we know a few pieces, and we basically make this into our Sleeping Beauty or Prince Charming. We aren't used to being happy. Yeah, this is worth elaboration. It says, we believe we seek happiness and love, but it's not quite as simple. What we really seek is familiarity, which basically is going to complicate any plans we have for happiness. We recreate in adult relationships some of the feelings we knew in childhood. As children, we first came to know and understand what love meant, but unfortunately, the lessons that we picked up may not have been straightforward. They involve all kinds of manipulation and, in short, suffering. As adults, we may then tend to reject certain healthy candidates whom we encounter, not because they're wrong, but precisely because they are too right, they're too well-balanced, too mature, too understanding, too reliable. And this rightness feels unfamiliar and alien, almost oppressive. That is a great insight. In the Christian life, when you start out doing something right, it's going to feel wrong because why? You've been really good at doing it badly. And then when you hear something different, it's like, oh, well, that doesn't feel right, so it must be wrong, and my feelings are always right. No, your feelings are almost always wrong. That's one of the points they come up with. So we marry the wrong people because the right ones feel wrong, undeserved, because we have no experience of health, and we don't really think that we believe ourselves worthy. It's going to come a little later. What's this one here? Oh, instinct has too much prestige. It's basically they're reacting against the social order where things were arranged and rationality, and then they basically show the flaws of that, and they really do a caricature of it. Then they come down to we don't go to schools of love. People don't research how relationships are supposed to work. I mean, if you're going to be involved in them, research them. Find out all you can about them. That's why I like Helen Fisher. She spent 30 years doing it. Then their basic thing is, you know, in romantic age, we have the rational, then we have the romantic, and their big solution is psychology solves all. You know, it's a really limited, immature perspective. This one is great. We want to freeze happiness. We have a desperate, fateful urge to try to make nice things permanent. And they give the example of a couple that goes to Venice. And, you know, there's the canal, there's the gondolier singing, there's the pigeons in St. Mark's Square, there's, you know, the little fish restaurant, there's all the great stuff. And you fall and you want to recreate that. So you say, will you marry me? And then, you know, you go back home and there's no St. Mark's Square, there's no gondolier singing, there's none of that stuff. And all that stuff that supported the feeling that you have is no longer there, and you left with a person, and you, from their perspective, and I would agree, it's like, this was not a good idea, because all those, it's really hard to bring a Venetian canal into your living room. I mean, it's just like, the gondola, you could probably do a reduced version of it, but all that other stuff, the pigeons, I mean, come on, it's just not going to work. So we want to freeze happiness, beware of that, and that's because our relationship with God is unsatisfying. We believe we're special. We want to stop thinking about love and just, you know, move on with it. So it's a decent article, has a lot of things to not like, but I do commend it to you because it's educational. Okay, so you got contact. There's some reciprocity. Then there is commonality. This is where you start developing social and intellectual intimacy. That's the first start. It's a more rational process because once the brain chemicals kick in, you're in trouble. Jesus was the one with the well-established points of contact and commonality, and that's another, and I'm going to run out of time because I just used up that time back then. So what we have here is Fisher does something, and I don't agree with it, but I threw it in for your consideration. She links the brain chemicals. This is the dopamine, this is the serotonin, testosterone, whatever, with different personality types. Myers-Briggs has the same kind of tendencies that people have. And I bring this point up is there should be a psychological compatibility. It's like it's good to understand the other person and say, is there a fit? Do we have commonality? There's a book by Mayhall's called Marriage Takes More Than Love, which is excellent. It's what I always recommend people read for premarital counseling. They have another one, which I don't recommend, called Opposites Attack. And the thing is opposites attract, and they cross it out in the title page and they put attack. And ultimately, that thing that attracted us to someone, those differences cause a dislike down the road. So you observe, you appreciate, particularly this should come in a context of two disciples mutually serving their Lord by loving others, things we talked about in previous weeks. Out of that, a friendship develops. So in toil, time of your life, it's on the front page of truthbase.net. There's a series on friendship, and rule number one is first be a friend of God. But the thing I want to note, which I think really appropriate, is I compare two kinds of friendships, one to a masquerade ball and a biblical friendship to a mountain climb. Masquerade ball, you need the mask, you need externals. If you reveal who you really are to the other person, party's over. You take off the mask and they're not wearing a mask. Run. So it's always dependent upon the externals. It's the Venetian canal. If you don't have that, and people who only see others in certain fun settings, i.e. a date, don't know the real person. A mountain climb is the kind of relationship where people are committed to getting each other up the mountain. It's work, right? They are willing to risk their lives for the other person. They will rope themselves together so that if one falls, the others can kind of pull them together. Those are the right kind of relationships. Developing a deeper intimacy as you climb the mountain is the basis for a great friendship and marriage down the road. So you observe, you build a friendship. There's valuing, which is a desire, which eventually becomes a commitment to self-sacrifice for the other's highest happiness. In marriage, it's you sacrifice your singleness. And most people don't quite get that. The leaving part isn't just, the family unit. You move out of the basement or wherever. It's you leave behind the single lifestyle. And if you're, it's something that should be left as a member of a family of God, is you basically don't exist for yourself. You exist for the benefit of God and the others. So you want their highest happiness. And then another thing that's kind of fits in here, might not be direct, linear line here. There's a fondness and affection, such as a brother-sister relationship. You want what is in the other's best interest, which is a form of love. I had a sister who was 4 years older than I, and she would regularly beat me up until I got to be a little bigger, but no one else could beat me up because I was her brother. I was her punching bag. No one else could use her. She would come and defend me just so she could abuse me. So I was a little dysfunctional. The fondness that develops, I see this in my kids. They are fairly loyal to each other. They defend each other. They want to see each other's happiness. They would consider how it affects the others on a good day. So this commonality develops that people have things in common, where they're headed, how they're going to get there. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it, but there's a commonality. And if you basically are interacting with a person, you realize, we don't speak the same language. This is going to be really tough. I'm going to have a dictionary or an app, on my phone to be able to communicate with this person. And it just gets awkward. So Matt, as I mentioned this before, the Cornell, one of their family life departments, did a study Legacy Project, it's called. And they looked at what enabled couples to be happy in the long term. And the two things that stood out was a commitment to the institution and shared values. Gottman did a similar study, and I'm a fan of him, and you'll find a bunch of sermons on the web by him where I reviewed his work. Found out that affirming others is a key thought there. So any thoughts, questions on commonality?
What you said about sacrifice your singleness, I think would apply to any biblical single person. You said, like,
right,
exist not for yourself, but for the benefit of spouse and others. So, but there's still a biblical single person and a married biblical person are still separate. So there's still something else there, I think.
Oh, yeah, there's more. But, yeah, this is on the way. We're on the timeline. So yeah, up until this point, most of what I have said would apply to almost everybody in this room, because, you know, regardless of your marital state or inclination, it's a these are things of being part of the family of God. Okay, so we got the social part. Now we're at the intellectual and spiritual intimacy. Old Testament minor prophet that most people skip over because he's minor is Amos, and he has a line that's a truism: can two walk together unless they're agreed? I don't know, boss. This is a real tough one. If they're going to walk together, I guess they have to be agreed that they're going together. Yeah, got it. Yeah, right. So the answer to this one is yes, I think. So if you want people to have the similar congruent. That's, I think, a geometry term, some sort of angles where they kind of, I can't remember what. But their life purpose and life goals are headed in the same direction. They're being good stewards of what God has entrusted them, using it for his glory, and the two overlap. Matthew 6:33 said, seek first. That's like first as a priority, kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all this other stuff that you're concerned about is going to fall into place. It'll be added to you. If you're focused on obeying Jesus' great commission, make disciples teaching them to obey, and you're headed in that direction and you find another person headed in that direction, you've got great commonality, great life purpose. You're headed in the same direction. And it's in that context where I, with great fear and trepidation, mention this next word, desire. You have a desire for a permanent relationship. Now, most people go through, I could live with that person. Then when the, what's the middle chemical, kicks in? Bear which one it is. Dopamine, yeah. It's, I can't live without them. In fact, Helen Fisher considers that the key to romantic love is that you start obsessing about the person. She thinks it's a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing if you're going to be married to someone. But if you're in that, I'm not sure yet, you don't want to be obsessing about them. Because can't live with, can't live without, can live with, eventually gets to can't live with them. If your relationship with another person is based upon a romantic ideal of love, you will get to, I can't live with them. Because the chemicals subside. We cannot maintain it always continuous high. Our bodies are not made for that. We burn out. So you need to have a more rational basis for a relationship just based on, than just this romantic ideal. Helen Fisher's major theme of what enables couples to exist together is the ability to sustain positive illusions. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. If you think about two people meeting each other and they're both putting their best foot forward, be it left or right or whatever, and they don't step on each other's toes, it's good. We're moving, making progress in this relationship. We haven't done any physical damage and we're already 20 seconds into it. Woo! There's hope. You project a positive image. You project what you want to be. There are a few people disingenuous enough to, you know, outright lie, but they do exist. And you want to encourage a person to live up to that ideal. In fact, there's a guy I came across that says, you know, we lie to ourselves, but that's good because we're really not the person that we say we are, but we want to be that person. And if we work at it long enough, we'll get there. And that's a good thing. Paul addresses the believers at Corinth as saints. If you look at them, they are the most carnal critters around. Not only were they, you know, being mean to each other, they're being mean to Paul, and you know, to sacrifice for them and stuff like that. But he calls them saints, holy ones, and he wants them to live up to that. So sustaining a positive illusion, Helen Fisher has observed that as couples get old into the, you know, like when they turn 40, you know, or 50, or God forbid 60, or heaven help us 70, they keep going on, they do better at sustaining the positive illusion. That might have to do something to do with the fact they don't see as well. But anyway, sustaining positive illusion is a good thing. Then there's the whole meeting the family thing, the rents and, you know, the council and all that other stuff, but is there compatibility? The compatibility has to be on multiple levels. People have to be headed in the same direction. In the past, I kind of drew this and, you know, put God up at the center. You have guy and female, and the closer they are to God, the closer they will be able to be with each other. And that's the compatibility. One's headed to God and the other's not. No compatibility. It's horrible. So you don't want it to get into a relationship that's like that. Sorry, why didn't I show up? If you were paying any attention to the previous sermons, you know I am a huge proponent of doing God's will. Because God's will is good, acceptable, and perfect. Perfect means there's nothing better than it. Romans 12, 1 and 2 tells you how to get that. You're transformed by the renewing of your mind. You become, the word that is used for transformation there is a metamorphosis. You go from being a caterpillar to a butterfly. And this funnel is in Toil. It's also in Judges, I think. Just type in Will of God of Daily Truth Base. You can find it. Chet drew it for me when I was putting it together. He said, Chet, I need a funnel. He said, well, get me what one should look like. And I said, this is a funnel, Chet. Okay, I can draw that. Okay, put this information on it. All right, we do it. So this is given to reinforce this mantra. We cannot know God's subjective will for our lives unless we are obeying his objective will as revealed in his word. You gotta walk with God to be able to live the godly life. And if you want a godly relationship and a godly marriage, this is what you need. Otherwise, you have a self-centered one where, you know, you take each other for as long as we both shall like or lust, as opposed to love. So this is on your outline. You got the word, the commands, principles, examples. You don't have this, that part of your outline. Input, logic, these elements, and I've done this before. So, and then the leading of the Holy Spirit, which is not a feeling. Let's think about Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. My heart, my feeling, is overwhelmed. Father, if possible, take this cup from me. So how did Jesus feel about going to the cross and getting crucified the next day? Not so good. So frequently, was it God's will for it to happen? Yeah. Was the Spirit leading him into it? Yeah. How did he feel? This is very different. I've never really been crucified before. You know, so it can be sometimes awkward going the route that you haven't gone before, but if you're following the Spirit of God, that is what it is. So it's really, and it's not peace. It's not circumstances. Satan opens up far more doors than God does because far more people are not in a relationship with God where God could answer their prayers, and Satan is very happy to keep them there. But it's a supported conviction over time that this is God's will, and you're looking for holding it with an open hand, turning the hand upside down, still there. I should be able to do this with a trick like that. Still there, okay? And then shake it, and it doesn't fall. Oh, it must be God's will for me to hold on to this pen. Hallelujah. All right, so this is, you know, the will of God. I've done sermons on the will of God, and you really need to be seeking the will of God for your life on a daily basis in order to be able to figure it out on another basis. So there's the Creator as well. That's the same thing right here. I just repeated it. And then there's confirmation, you know, get parental, whether permission, blessing, all that other stuff. It's, you know, it's up for grabs in terms of what that is. But it's something to consider when you're in that stage of a relationship. The Creator's will is key. And you have to be able to understand how God talks. You have a record with him, and then you can actually have him guide you in interaction with another person. Okay, then when you're at that point, there's the communication. This is where you start developing spiritual and emotional intimacy. It's at the point where the couple is committed to, you know, I guess people don't always get married at an altar. They're walking down the aisle. They don't even have aisles anymore. Wherever, they're going to basically say, I do, you do, we do. Great, let's go. They're doing that I do thing. And they're committed to that unless something comes up that says, oops, didn't see this. So this basically is when you have the guard on, but people think it's God's will for them to walk down that path, and then they can start talking about what that path is. Someone starts talking about it too soon, they're usually trying to defraud the other person. Oh yeah, marriage, you know, and did someone say the M word? You know, and it's usually used as defrauding. So you explore and discuss the subject of marriage. This is like the hardest thing I think for a guy to do. It's like, oh no, what if I've been misreading everything up until this point? Well, you grow and learn. Then there's the engagement proposal. In the Old Testament times, a betrothal was considered as binding as marriage, unless there was, as Joseph discovered with Mary, she's what? and then he was wanting to divorce her, but they weren't yet married, but they were betrothed. And then you have the wedding and living plans, you know, that kind of fits in, and that brings out all kinds of stuff. And, you know, I used to think it's better to elope, because then you don't have to deal with that. But I thought, no, it's actually good to go through all the process because it sets a pattern for relating and it should be done with enough time to make it happen. And then there's premarital counseling and everything like that. What is frequently common, it's called buyer's remorse. It happens on a lot of things, not just in the spousability thing. And here's the mantra, never doubt in the dark what you've seen in the light. If you've seen it, something is God's will, be it a spouse, a job, anything else that you're following, then when it doesn't quite look like it's it, then you need to evaluate, why did I get into this in the first place? And you believe that this was God's will, then work it until you make it work. So faith is not a leap in the dark, but it's a step into the light. Anybody who says faith is a leap into the dark doesn't know what faith is all about, because all they see is dark. So it's up there, I don't know what it is, so just leap into it. Excuse me? how about stepping in the light? The metaphor in scripture is always walk. The word gives light. I don't see too much. There's one spot where it says leap over a wall when you're attacking your enemies in Psalm 18 or someplace like that. But everywhere else, it's a walk. You know where you're supposed to go. He didn't tell the nation of Israel, oh, wander around the desert. No, he actually guided them even when they were wandering. So, you know, you always want to be following the light. Okay, and then we get, I think it's our final C, consummation. You know this is inspired because they all start with C. Oh. this is where you get the physical intimacy. This is where it's okay to wake in love. And I've been asked over the years, well, you know, what about a kiss? And I had written something up, which I lost on what a kiss is. But I found someone, it's called Modestly Yours. I gave you the link. The woman, I think she's from Princeton, or a group of people, gave some implications of what a kiss was. And basically, way to frame this is a kiss is basically foreplay. Normally it's perceived of as that. So don't teach yourself to like things that aren't good. We kiss because it feels good. That's basically selfish, and the article will go through from a gal's perspective. So you want to figure out what's appropriate to express what to whom. You want to behave honorably. This is a great time to demonstrate other-centeredness, particularly if you're a guy. You want to take your cues from the gal, and if her cues are incorrect, then you stand firm on the holiness side, rather than not. I had one guy who said he wanted to get married because he couldn't control himself. And 1 Corinthians 7 says it's better to marry than burn. He got married and he got burned. it's lots of conflict because he hadn't learned to have his will and desires submitted to God. And the questions are going to be real short. I'll go through these. Is it God's will that everybody married? Absolutely not. 1 Corinthians 7 says there is a higher ideal in some people's minds of not being married. Advantages, disadvantages, just talk to someone who is married. They'll tell you that. Sleeping the will of God, sleeping clinic. What's a sleeping clinic? A sleeping clinic is something that helps you stay asleep. So what helps you stay asleep in the will of God in this subject matter? You're in it. So that's, are platonic relationships possible? Yes, but they are rare. Shouldn't we be desiring the highest interest of all we meet, irregardless of their main potential? Absolutely. So practice other-centeredness. You should basically, your goal as a guy should be to see women, guys and women become children of God and laborers for God, and vice versa. If you're a woman, same thing. If someone can't trust God to provide what's best when it's best, are they believing Satan's oldest lie that God isn't good? Should be a question mark, and the answer is yes. That they're just, you know, Satan has blinded them. And here's something to make it more applicable. Have you committed yourself to holiness and trusting God to bring about his perfect will in your lifetime? When did you do that? Something you should do somewhere down the road. Okay, any other questions? 2 minutes.
Could you go back up? You mentioned you were going to come back up to that service when your God
Sure. All right. So marriage is two people getting together not to have their needs met. Not to have their needs met by the other person. Because you can be perfectly content and complete as a single person in solitary confinement for your faith. You can have all the fruits of the Spirit. You can have joy. You can have love. You can have peace. You can have everything if God is meeting your needs. So it's not to get your needs met. It's to reflect God's unity. So the couple comes together as one in marriage, and they have a harmony and a subordination just like the Trinity does. They are self-sacrificial. You know, the Father planned, the Son saved, Spirit seals. They work together, sacrificing. Jesus had the biggest part of that, but then you could say the Father sacrificed a lot in having his Son die, so there's that other-centered love. And they do it for the eternal objective, to bring together a company of people to rule with the Messiah in the future. That was part of God's plan, to demonstrate his love to the world. And we should be doing the same thing in all of our relationships, whether it holds promise for a marriage or not. Or even if it is a marriage. So the potential is, it might lead to a marriage, but that this is still, there should be unity, there should be other-centeredness, there should be, you know, eternal objectives in mind. And when you're married, it's the same thing. It doesn't really change. That's the objective for marriage. That's it. Who's here? Time to pray and eat. Heavenly Father, thank you that you are the God who created all that is good. After you created Adam and Eve, you saw that it was good and pronounced it as very good. Thank you that marriage done right can be really, really good. Thank you that also we have examples of where people walk in the wrong way. They don't experience your blessings, and that gives us motivation to want to do it the right way. Thank you that you are perfectly capable of revealing your will and making it clear what you want your children to do as they seek you. I pray for all of us that we would be diligent to seek you, to do the things that please you, knowing that at your right hand are pleasures forevermore, that you are the God who can open that hand and satisfy the desires of every living thing. So thank you that we can trust you. We don't have to stress or fret. We know that you will provide what's best when it's best, because no good thing do you withhold from them who have walked uprightly. God, we believe you for this. We trust you for this. And we await your sustenance and grace for all that we need. Thanks for our food. In Christ's name, amen.